Let's begin by turning in our Bibles to the book of Matthew chapter 8. And we'll read the subject passage of our lecture this morning. Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13. It says, "And when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, imploring him, saying, 'Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented.' Jesus said to him, 'I will come and heal him.' But the centurion said, 'Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my centurion will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it.' Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, 'Truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from the east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.' And Jesus said to the centurion, 'Go, it shall be done for you as you have believed.' And the centurion was healed, or the servant was healed that very moment." Now, there's also a parallel account with some similarities and some differences in the book of Luke. And I wanted to say that I appreciate the elders for the opportunity to participate in this series of lectures. The theme of this series of lectures is conversations with Jesus. Each week, the lecture will focus on one of the many personal encounters with Jesus that are documented for us in the New Testament. And I'll say that I'm not one that's very keen on being front and center, but the topic is absolutely wonderful. I think Simon baited me a couple of years ago with another topic. It was similar. It was what Jesus said about certain topics. If it seems kind of like a stream of consciousness, it kind of is. I prepared this over the course of a couple of months. A lot of it was things I thought of while I was driving or when I had a few minutes to study, or like last week, walking around the streets of Disney World. So I just hope I can do it. Hope I can do it justice. As you would guess by the passage I read, my topic this morning is on the centurion's encounter with Jesus. There's a lot I could discuss in this 45 minutes or so, but I'll try to get to as much as I can. In studying for this, I found several things that were of interest that would be good to discuss. One would be the centurion saying, "I also am a man under authority." This centurion was very familiar with having people, with having authority over people. He clearly saw that Jesus had much greater authority. And another topic might be that he said he wasn't worthy for Jesus to come into his house. And considering a man like him, I wonder, did he say this where other people heard him? And I'm guessing that he did, because Matthew and Luke both wrote it in their books. A third thing that we could talk about might be, it says Jesus marveled. And think about this, what kind of things do we marvel at? In my life, I've marveled at things like the birth of my children, or the size of the universe, or technological achievements in space exploration. Last summer, I marveled at the clear air in Montana. Like amazing views from mountaintops when I've been hiking or skiing. But here, the Son of God marvels at what the centurion said. That seems like a really important idea. Jesus' response began with, "I have not found such great faith." And he said, "I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel." This doesn't seem like just a passing remark or an observation. This is Jesus affirmatively saying that this non-Jew's faith is greater. Another topic might be Jesus talking about many coming from the east and the west to recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. This hints at non-Jews from all over the world being invited into the kingdom of heaven. As we know, this did happen not too far in the future, in the book of Acts. More on that a little later. Jesus said that the sons of the kingdom will be cast into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I just imagine what the other Jews and their leaders, this centurion's followers, Jesus' followers, the apostles and his earthly family would have thought about Jesus talking like this. I think all of these observations are remarkable and worthy of serious study and comment. However, I decided I want to spend more time talking about the situation itself and about the centurion's request. I've titled the lecture, The Centurion's Request. When I imagine this situation and study further, I'm amazed that a centurion would even make this request to Jesus. It's also amazing that he asked in the way that he did from a standpoint of humility. I want to make an attempt to bring it to life. It's a real situation. When I've taught the kids Bible classes, I've told them about the mind's eye. I wanted them to actually picture the situation and things in a Bible story, like they were seeing it firsthand, to actually see the situation in their mind. And to a fault, I'm the type of person that has more questions than answers most of the time. I want to understand all the parts and pieces of a subject so I can really understand it. So I wanted to kind of give a nutshell of the political situation in Israel at the time. It was complicated, to say the least. You know, many parts and moving pieces, and you know, I just was able to glean what I could to help understand what this is about. The Romans conquered Jerusalem in 63 B.C., which would have only been about 80 to 90 years before this situation occurred. When that happened, 12,000 Jews were killed, and the Roman general that did it had no regard for God and walked right into the most holy place. I think his name was Pompey. Now, this was an abomination, as only the high priest was allowed to go there. Since then, Israel was no longer independent, but was occupied by the Roman military, and it was ruled by leaders which were put in place by the Roman Empire. Israel was granted some autonomy and had to pay tribute to the Roman Empire. It was ultimately subject to their rule. The Romans appointed a high priest. His name was Hyrcanus II. He was later some kind of king at some point in time, and then later Caiaphas that we've read about in the book of Acts. Then Roman Emperor Julius Caesar appointed Antipater I as the Roman procurator. He was a builder of what's known as the founder of what's known as the Herodian dynasty. His family had actually converted to Judaism a generation or two before. His son was Herod the Great, and he was the main Herod that we read about in history. He was actually designated the King of the Jews or the King of Judea by the Roman Senate in 40 B.C. When he died, the kingdom was then ruled simultaneously by four people, including three of his sons, and that's why they're called tetrarchs. I think the New Testament mentions tetrarchs at one point in time. One son, Herod Antipas, was made ruler of Galilee and Perea. Sources say he's probably the person most referenced as Herod in the New Testament. This is the one that was mentioned in Luke 13:32. The people told Jesus that Herod had threatened to kill him. And Jesus responded, "Go and tell that fox." So very bold thing to say at that point in time. He's also the one that beheaded John the Baptist, and the one later mentioned during the trial of Jesus. He's the one that sent Jesus back to Pilate's court. There was a second son, Herod Archelaus, who was given another part of the kingdom, including Edom and Samaria. He ruled for 10 years until 6 AD when he was banished. There was a third son, Herod Philip, who was given jurisdiction over the northeast part of the kingdom. He ruled there until his death in 34 AD. I think that our topic here was somewhere around 25 to 30 AD. Now there were, you know, one died in 6 A.D. or one was banished in 6 A.D. and there were lots of rulers in and out. Luke 3:1 mentions the three tetrarchs' name as Herod, Philip, and Lysanias. Now there was also a Roman governor named Pontius Pilate. He was installed by Rome. Now, after this, the Herodian dynasty did continue on, although in limited forms. I think, from what I could tell, the kingdom was kind of falling apart, becoming more and more disjointed. There was Agrippa I. He was the grandson of Herod. He was raised in Rome, close to Caesar. He later became ruler over Judea, and he had somehow gone to Rome and caused his uncle Herod, Antipas, to be deposed from power at some point. Then there was the Agrippa mentioned in the book of Acts. The early chapters, chapter 12 in Acts, names him Herod, but Herod Agrippa, I believe, is the consensus on who that would have been. He gained more and more parts of the kingdom until he died in 44 A.D. And they say he's the one who had James executed. His son, Agrippa II, was then ruler until 92 A.D. He's probably the one who dealt with the Apostle Paul later in the book of Acts, chapters 25 and 26. One of the Herods was the one mentioned in Matthew chapter 2, who was searching for the baby Jesus in order to kill him. This may have been the original Herod the Great. He would have been an old man at that point in time. And you remember when he couldn't find him, because Jesus and Mary had fled to Egypt in order to protect him, he ordered all the baby boys in and around Bethlehem to be killed. I've heard that called the slaughter of the innocents. Now let's think about that for a minute. If this centurion was an officer and was probably a career soldier in Herod's army, let's say if he was 50 plus years old, 30 years before when this slaughter of the innocents occurred, he may have been a young soldier when that happened. May have participated in mass killings of male infant Jews in and around Bethlehem. I would think the Jews would have a very poor opinion of the soldiers and the centurions that were around at that point in time. Now, there were also rebellions from time to time in various regions. Several years before Jesus was born, there was a large rebellion in Galilee, which people refused to pay taxes. Herod, of course, put this down. He put it down viciously with the military. Now remember, Jesus was from this area, so there would have been a lot of bad blood with the people Jesus was raised around against Herod and the soldiers. There were mass executions on several occasions. One time, Herod executed a group of students who had torn down an eagle monument, which was a symbol of Rome. It was a Roman symbol. He had put it on the walls of the temple. And Herod had their teachers and the students that did this, had them burned. And then this event sparked what's known as the Passover Uprising, resulting in the deaths of 3,000 Jews. Herod's army and centurions would have been the ones who carried out these types of atrocities. He also executed and murdered several of his own family members, including one of his wives and a couple of his sons. On the other hand, Herod knew that he had to work with the people. The Jewish high priests were politically powerful, and he wanted their support. He wanted the support of the Jewish people. He undertook political efforts to satisfy the Jewish people, including ambitious building projects. One was rebuilding the temple. He pretty much built it very well. With large stones. I think they quarried them from the same place that Solomon did. It was very huge. That was kind of his pinnacle achievement, I've heard some people say. It was partly a palace and partly like a shopping mall. It was used for religious worship and for business and tourism. You'll remember Jesus and the money changers, that scene that happened there at the temple. In fact, the Jews still worship at Herod's Western Wall. Those pictures that you see of people at that wall, that old wall, those are blocks that Herod had put in place. Mark chapter 8, verse 15, Jesus said, "Beware of the leaven of Herod." This was a warning to people to beware of idols and hypocrisy and lies which were spreading from the Roman culture. He also covertly mocked the rulers in Luke chapter 7, verse 24 through 26. Said, talking about John the Baptist, people that were coming from John the Baptist. He said, "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? A man dressed in soft clothing and living in luxury? Those who are splendidly clothed and live in luxury are found in royal palaces." I read somewhere that this reed shaken by the wind comment was a reference to a depiction of a reed on a royal coin. And it was that Herod was the one that was driven any direction by Rome and other influences. And I also looked into what is a centurion and what was their role in the kingdom at that time. The word centurion, century, indicates they were in charge of 100 soldiers. However, it was probably more like 80 or so during this time period. He would have been like what we consider an officer in the army, like a lieutenant or a captain. In each legion of the army, which was the main division of the army at that point, there were 6 to 10 cohorts. In each cohort, there would have been 5 to 8 centuries. A centurion was in charge of each century. He had to be able to read and write. He had to be at least 30 years old. He earned anywhere from 4 to 10 times as much as a normal soldier. He had his own tent and his own horse. He was normally promoted from among the ranks of the army. He would have been distinguished in terms of his size and strength, and for his skill in using his weapon and throwing spears, using a sword. He was solely responsible for the exercise and training and discipline and the conduct and appearance of all the soldiers that reported to him. Some of them were promoted from the ranks, and some of them were appointed directly by the Roman Senate, usually a result of displays of valor on the battlefield. He would lead through example. His rank was similar to what, like I said, we think of as a captain or a lieutenant. He actually led his soldiers in the battlefield. They led from the front and were expected to lead by example, displaying skill and courage that would have caused them to be promoted to that rank. Roman armies were very organized, very disciplined. They had very rigorous training. That was their main advantage over the other armies of the world. I think this is the primary reason they were so successful, why their empire was so large. Discipline was strictly enforced, often through fear. I found one source that said soldiers were stoned to death if they committed any act which could be construed as cowardly or out of order. I also found a source which said centurions always carried vine branches in order to strike and discipline any soldier that was in violation of strict discipline. This centurion wouldn't technically have been a part of the Roman army. He belonged to the royal troops of Herod. Since Herod was appointed by Rome, he would have been expected to maintain an army in order to rule the land. Herod's army also followed orders from Rome and provided Rome with military support when needed. The Jews didn't serve in the army, so this centurion and all of his soldiers would have been Gentiles. Herod's army was organized the same way a Roman army was, and used the same ranks and titles. Herod's army would have spent a lot of their time and efforts fighting border wars and enforcing the rule and authority of Herod and the Romans, enforcing their laws and taxes. In the urban areas like Jerusalem, their role would have been something more like the police. They would have always been around. And though they were more like the police, they would always been a reminder to the people of the ruthless leaders that they had, including Herod and the Romans. Their soldiers were the ones who carried out crucifixions. They did this regularly. Civilians would have been scared of them, regarding them as cruel and violent and self-serving. So wonder this, I try to picture this situation in my mind. What would Jesus have thought when this centurion was approaching him? He's the Son of God. I'm sure he wasn't scared or intimidated, but, you know, it's interesting to think about nonetheless. I was looking for examples of centurions, like real-life examples of what they did in history. There's a first-century historian that is mentioned regularly, Josephus. He depicted the centurions as leading their soldiers in battle over walls and into the fray of combat with great strengths of bravery and courage. I wanted to read a couple of excerpts I found from his writings. Josephus wrote about a centurion named Julian in his account of the destruction of Jerusalem. And I'll read it. But there was one Julian, a centurion, that came from Bithynia, a man he was of great reputation, whom I had formerly seen in that war, and was one of the highest fame, both for his skill in war, his strength of body, and the courage of his soul. This man, seeing the Romans giving ground and in a sad condition, for he stood by Titus at the tower of Antonia, he leaped out and of himself alone put the Jews to flight. When they were already conquerors and made them retire as far as the corner of the inner court of the temple, from him the multitude fled away in crowds, as supposing that neither his strength nor his violent attacks could be those of a mere man. Accordingly, he rushed through the midst of the Jews as they were dispersed all abroad and killed those that he caught. Nor indeed was there any sight that appeared more wonderful in the eyes of Caesar or more terrible to others than this. Josephus also wrote about two other centurions named Furius and Fabius in his writing called Antiquities of the Jews. And I'll read an excerpt from that as well. But when the battering engine was brought near, the greatest of the towers was shaken by it and fell down and broke down a part of the fortifications. So the enemy poured in apace, and Cornelius Faustus, the son of Sylla, with his soldiers. He first of all ascended the wall, and next to him Furius, the centurion, with those that followed on the other part, while Fabius, who was also a centurion, ascended in the middle with a strong body of men after him. But now all was full of slaughter, some of the Jews being slain by the Romans, and some by one another. Nay, some were there who threw themselves down the precipices and put fire to their houses and burnt them, and not able to bear the miseries they were under. Of the Jews there fell 12,000, but of the Romans very few. So that kind of gives a picture of a centurion and the role that they played and who they were. As I noted earlier, I found it extremely interesting, the centurion's question itself. It's remarkable that we consider the whole picture here, the Roman occupation, how the soldiers would have interacted with the people and the Jews, how they would have interacted with the Roman soldiers. I think we can make sense of it when we consider what Jesus had been doing. When we consider what the centurion saw Jesus do and the faith that he had apparently developed. As mentioned earlier, a centurion's salary would have been several times as much as a normal soldier. He would have had enough money to pay for a support staff. I would guess that this servant that's mentioned was an employee of his household. This centurion apparently really loved his servants and considered them like family. It's an indication of what kind of man he was. Remember, this man was a big, tough, experienced, hardened warrior, tough disciplinarian, and probably a very intense and scary man. And we can see that this type of person doesn't necessarily have any less love for people than somebody who we would normally consider that loves people in that way. He must have been strongly moved with love in order to seek help from someone who his colleagues and his leaders would have considered as one of the poor people, one of the conquered and subjugated people. Also, his Roman leaders and the Jewish leaders considered Jesus as a rebel and a blasphemer. So it would have been quite a risk for Roman soldiers and this centurion to even approach him in a friendly way. Whether the centurion thought this way about Jesus or whether he thought he was the Son of God, either way required a great degree of humility and hope and faith in what he could do. I'm sure this is true because of the response that Jesus gave him. So I think we see what a strange situation this is, what an odd interaction between two people. And I also thought about, why did he ask? Why did he make this request? In the text, Jesus said the centurion had to ask as a result of his faith. Let's consider that point. How did the centurion get faith? As mentioned earlier, the centurion and soldiers also had general policing duties. In addition to their soldiering duties that we would normally think of, they would have interacted with the people on a daily basis. At this point in time, Jesus was attracting large crowds wherever he went. Huge crowds were gathering to hear him speak and to see the miracles that he was performing. Now, just before our main passage here, let's turn back a little bit in Matthew chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. It says, when Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him. And a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately the leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, see that you tell no one, but go, show yourself to the priest, and present the offering that Moses commanded as a testimony to them. Now we'll assume that the centurion didn't see this one, since Jesus told the leper not to even tell anybody. Now just before this, Matthew chapter 7, at the end of that chapter, let's read a few verses there. Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 29. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. When Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching as one having authority and not as the scribes. Now this centurion and soldiers would have been listening to speeches wherever the crowds were gathered. They would have been scrutinizing anything Jesus said. They would have been listening for any kind of talk against Herod or the government. And they could arrest anyone who spoke in rebellion. And remember, they didn't have any First Amendment protections, any freedom of speech like we did. They didn't allow any kind of speech against Herod, the Roman Empire, or Caesar. This would have been the centurion's and the soldier's mindset. Verse 29 gives a clue of what's different here and what the centurion would have recognized and what produced the faith that Jesus acknowledged. They heard Jesus speaking with authority, and the crowds were amazed at these things. We read it and kind of gloss over it, but it's really profound. I tried to imagine what it would take today for me to be amazed at someone's speech. I've been impressed many times with political speeches or lessons or sermons at church. I can honestly say I've never been amazed. That's a different word, a different idea. So I try to think of what would it take. Think of all the problems in the world today with sin and immorality, materialism. If someone spoke with such authority that it attracted huge crowds and they were amazed, and this is right out of the general public, like say if somebody just gathered an impromptu gathering here at Oak Mountain Amphitheater and the crowds were amazed. That's kind of what happened here. It's really amazing when you think about it. This centurion would have seen Jesus perform miracles like the one he was asking Jesus to do. Could that be what produced the faith that Jesus said the centurion had? Let's flesh that out for just a minute. Let's go to Matthew chapter 4, verses 23 to 25. Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. The news about him spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all those who were ill, those suffering with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Large crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis and Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan. And there's a good chance this centurion and the soldiers saw these things. However, Jesus made it clear that these miracles didn't produce faith by themselves. In fact, when Jesus started teaching difficult things in John chapter 6, many, if not most, of the people left. Let's turn to John chapter 6, verse 66 to 69. As a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So Jesus said to the 12, "You do not want to go away also, do you?" Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God." Now notice what Peter said here. "You have the words of eternal life. We have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God." Now Jesus was marveling at this centurion's faith. So I suspect his faith would have been somewhat like Peter's in that passage. Let's back up a little more in John chapter 6, verses 26 to 34. Jesus answered them and said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not work for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you, for on him the Father God has set his seal." Therefore they said to him, "What shall we do that we may see, that we may work the works of God?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." And they said to him, "What will you do for a sign so that we may see and believe you? What work will you perform? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written. He gave them bread out of heaven to eat." Jesus then said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, it is not Moses who has given you the bread out of heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread out of heaven. For the bread of God is that which comes down out of heaven and gives life to the world." Then they said to him, "Lord, always give us this bread." And Jesus went on to explain that he was the bread. The people were disappointed at this because they came to see miracles and to get free food. And they left when Jesus started teaching these difficult things. We often mention Romans 10:17. That's the passage that says, "So faith comes from hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ." This centurion's faith was clearly a result of hearing and believing Jesus. Remember, the main passage is in Matthew chapter 8. The prior three chapters, 5, 6, and 7, were full only of Jesus speaking and teaching. This centurion's request comes in chapter 8, and those prior three chapters were very difficult and probably would have caused many to leave, just like we read about in John chapter 6. Chapter 5 was the Sermon on the Mount with the Beatitudes. Some of those were, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the gentle, the salt of the earth, the light of the world, city on a hill, settling with your adversary, lusting after a woman, adultery, divorce, turn the other cheek. If a man asks you to go with him 1 mile, go with him 2. If he asks for your shirt, give him your coat also. Love your enemies. Do not store up treasures on earth. Materialism, judging others, casting pearls before the swine, the golden rule, the narrow and the wide gates, and others." If the centurion still believed after all that, he must have taken this to heart and agreed with it. Think about this, that he had the degree of faith that Jesus said he did Just think of what kind of changes a man like him would have had to have made in his life. Think about what he would have had to do to bring his life into conformance with Jesus' teaching. Imagine what he would have been required to change his mind about. We're not told more about this centurion, but I'd be willing to bet that he actually did those things. That he actually made those changes. And I'm sure the next chapter in his life would have been very interesting. The other point is, this centurion recognized Jesus' authority. Back to our main passage in verse 8 and 9. But the centurion said, "Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word and my centurion will be healed. For I also am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it." He said, "I also am a man under authority." There are a couple of meanings here. He obviously recognized Jesus' authority over physical things. After all, he was asking asking Jesus to heal his servant. The bigger meaning here is that he recognized Jesus' authority in general. At that point in time, I think people didn't fully understand the scope of Jesus' authority, or even understood that he was the Son of God. After all, even his apostles didn't fully understand it. Let's remember the context here. In the past three chapters, Jesus had been speaking and teaching. Remember what we read in the end of Matthew chapter 7? When Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching as one having authority and not as their scribes. It's clear at this point that crowds recognized Jesus' authority just based on the words that he was speaking. Just imagine that you're hearing the Son of God speak. If he wants to come across with power and authority in a particular speech, I'm sure he has a superb ability to do just that. This centurion himself would have been familiar with how to speak with authority. So it's clear that he would have recognized that Jesus had authority. In verse 8, the centurion said, "Lord, I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof." It's clear the centurion took a point of humility, recognizing that Jesus' authority was much greater than his. Now let's move on to Jesus' response. Let's look at the book of Luke, the parallel passage in Luke this time. Luke chapter 7 and verse 9. It says, "Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him and turned and said to the crowd that was following him, 'I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith.'" I mentioned earlier some of the things I've marveled at in my life, and I think we're all probably similar in that regard, but the Son of God marvels at what this centurion said. Let's consider this. It seems very important that the Son of God marvels at something like this. Now let's move back over to Matthew, and it kind of goes on to the next point. "Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, 'Truly I say to you, I've not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from the east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven.'" This foretells that the gospel will be extended to the Gentiles and the rest of the world. This was fulfilled in the household of Cornelius. Acts 10, 1 and 2, that's where we find that. It says, "Now there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what has been called the Italian cohort, a devout man and one who feared God with all his household and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually." So this was also a centurion. Is that a coincidence? The parallel passage with Luke, let's go back to that. It adds some additional detail. It says, when he heard about Jesus, he sent Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave. When they came to Jesus, they earnestly implored him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it is he who built us our synagogue." Now, this similar account from Luke adds a very odd detail. It says that the Jewish elders were at odds with Jesus. But here they're asking him on behalf of this centurion to do a miracle. And telling Jesus that this centurion is worthy. Also, it's interesting that they apparently had to be beholden to this centurion, because they were doing what he asked them to do. And I'm sure that they didn't want to do this. A little later in Matthew, the Jewish elders are questioning Jesus' authority. This is after they had requested him to do a miracle as the Son of God. Matthew 21:23 says, "When he entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him while he was teaching and said, 'Lord, by what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority?'" And again in Matthew 26:3-4, "Then the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, and they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him." Luke chapter 22:52 and other passages say the elders were also involved in Jesus' arrest and eventual crucifixion. In addition to this centurion and Cornelius, there's another centurion mentioned in the New Testament. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 27, which tells of a centurion who was present at Jesus' crucifixion. Matthew 27, verse 54. "Now the centurion and those who were with him, keeping guard over Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, became very frightened and said, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" Now Luke 23 gives the account of the same event. It adds that this centurion who was present at the crucifixion did something else. Luke 23:44-49. "That was about the sixth hour, and darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour, because the sun was obscured. And the veil of the temple was torn in two. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' Having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what happened, he began praising God, saying, 'Certainly this man was innocent.' And all the crowds who came together for this spectacle, when they observed what had happened, began to return, beating their breasts. And all his acquaintances and the women who accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, seeing these things." This centurion began praising God. And the next verse mentioned people followed his lead, and they realized what had been done. This centurion thing, this makes three in the New Testament that kind of have the same theme. So here is the conclusion. The thing that I really took away from this was that Jesus marveled. We all marvel at things, but what does it mean that Jesus marveled at this? Upon reflecting on this, I think it's really profound. Jesus existed in the spiritual realm. He was temporarily present on earth, but he was fully motivated and existed in the spiritual. That's where we need to get to also. That's the real reality. Conflict between spiritual and physical is mentioned so many times in the New Testament. We work on this throughout our lives. And it begins when we confess our faith and obey the gospel to become a Christian. If Jesus marveled at this, then that means that this centurion had done that. He had believed and confessed. He believed the words of Jesus. And we can too. Thank you.